This is the Music Publishing Podcast with your host, Dennis Tobenski. Join Dennis in his weekly nuts and bolts conversations with composers, performers, and other arts professionals as they navigate their careers as concert musicians in the 21st century. And now your host, Dennis Tobenski.
Hello, and welcome to the Music Publishing Podcast. I'm back after a little summertime hiatus, and a quick announcement before I announce this week's guests. I talked recently, or one of my last episodes, about the New Music Shelf call for scores, and just some quick numbers to tell you like how amazing that turned out to be. We had 264 composers from 17 countries submit 925 songs for consideration for these anthologies. So the curators and I have our work cut out for us over the next couple of months. If you're a part of that, we'll keep you informed about everything as we go along. So yeah, that's that quick announcement. And so this week, joined by Elizabeth Alexander and J. David Moore from the Independent Music Publishers Cooperative. Welcome, guys.
Welcome. Hello. Thank you.
thanks for being
good to be here.
Yeah, I met the both of you briefly, very very briefly, back in 2013 at the ACDA National Convention.
In Dallas,
yeah. Abby Bettinas, she and I chatted quite a bit, and then she introduced me to a lot of you. So it's nice to chat with you again. Could you, the two of you, just like give us a little bit of background about yourselves?
Sure. Ah, Elizabeth, you come first in the alphabet.
I come first in the alphabet. But we're exactly the same age, so I didn't come first that way, just only in the alphabet. So, well, my background is my training is all the way through undergrad and grad school at the College of Worcester and Cornell University. And I got out of Cornell University with this brand spanking new doctorate in music composition, and realized I didn't want to teach. I wanted to really be creating music. I had some other things I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And for several years, I floundered around writing, a bassoon piece and a clarinet piece and a brass quartet and a choir piece. Just one of every, all these different pieces. And it wasn't terribly satisfying. I realized I wasn't making ongoing relationships. Mm-hmm. They were kind of these one-offs. And so often a performer would say to me, what else do you have for me in my instrumentation? And I would always say, or almost always say, oh no, I only have this one piece. So at some point I decided to grab a genre that I liked and create a body of music, some body of music, with that genre. And I picked choral music. I liked it, and I had two pieces. I guess I thought that was a critical mass. And I began writing choral pieces and making relationships with these conductors. And that grew into self-publishing, which is what I was doing when I moved to Minnesota in 2003. And I already knew David a little bit, as his reputation as an arranger preceded him. Minnesota proved to be a terrific place to be writing for choirs, to be selling music. And that became, that really became my home.
Nice.
Was writing choral music and songs. So I'll just stop there. And, because the rest of the story will probably have David in it.
I had no idea you picked choral music kind of out of a hat like that.
I did. I was not even a whole lot of a choral singer. I was in choirs, but I actually tried out for lots of choirs I didn't get into. Not like you, David, and some of the other members of the Independent Publishers Cooperative. But I also always loved songs. So texts and songs. I loved writing my lyrics and using other people's words. So it wasn't just random.
Nice.
Well, I did take piano lessons from, I guess, fourth grade through 12th grade. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, choral music is how I have identified myself as a musician really my entire life since I was six. So that love and also the intense social experience that is the high school choral department really defined my direction, I guess, in college. So I did go to Florida State University and Cincinnati Conservatory for composition, but it was always because of choral music. Mm. Even when I was writing other things, the reason I was there was because of my experience and I always felt like my primary instrument was the choir, or mm-hmm. was the vocal ensemble of some kind. Not even my individual voice, but the ensemble was the instrument that I knew about. And after graduate school, I started a professional a cappella group in Cincinnati. And the way those things go, when you have a group of musicians around you regularly, and you have some creative inclinations to begin with, well, you want to start writing for them. You want to start kind of, because, I knew those voices so well and how those voices went together. And because I had my arranging training had been in high school as a barbershop singer. So I had already had some experience with putting vocal parts together, I guess, in that regard. But that first group was kind of my training. And because of the relative renown, that's too grand a word, but the fact that we were known to a degree in Cincinnati got me involved with a women's choir, Muse, which got me into the Gala Network, the Gay Lesbian Choir Network. And Muse was a very kind of seminal feminist women's choir in the network and nationally. So when I started writing for them, arranging for them, suddenly I was getting requests for pieces that I had done for them from Ithaca, as it turned out.
He's mentioning that because it was as the conductor of a gala choir in Ithaca that I was looking for the best arrangement of Everything Possible, that song, Everything Possible, in the world. And I checked out a whole bunch, and David Moore had a killer arrangement of that song.
Nice.
So in some ways, that was the writing for Muse Choir and writing for my own groups, that one in Cincinnati and one subsequently in the Twin Cities, was kind of the laboratory that I kind of learned the real world part of the craft. And after a while, it was really only, I guess, 12 years ago that I looked at this closet full of scores that I had that were just kind of sitting there. And they didn't fit into any particular market, really, or any particular existing publisher's niche. So that's the point where I thought, I ought to try to monetize this somehow. And so that's when I really became started publishing the work that I had that hadn't already been published.
Yeah, if you don't mind, you were talking about what your seminal experiences were and why you decided to publish, and that my reasons are not unlike David's.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really attracted to pieces that don't fit into that little choral 2.5 to 3.5 minute model.
Yeah,
probably right. Because I didn't spend years and years and years as a choral singer.
Mm-hmm.
So when I thought about creating a song, I thought, well, wow, it could be like, you know, one of Stephen Sondheim's 5 or 6 minute pieces.
Yeah.
So I would write choir pieces that were 5 or 6 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would write, pieces that were about unusual topics.
Mm-hmm.
Things that weren't your typical, love and hope and song, which are wonderful things to sing about. But I had pieces that were about, back then, it was always harder to explain. One of my earliest pieces was about how music, whether it was secular or sacred, was kind of all the same world, and we don't know where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe a musician is God. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't write the poem, but it was on a Philip Dacey poem. But it did not have a sound bite. I couldn't mm-hmm. sell that to a publisher.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And so that was also my reason for self-publishing. The publishers I spoke to about publishing were just baffled. They mm-hmm. they had no right. idea what they would do with what I was creating
yeah.
for choir.
Elizabeth, I'm sorry to cut in, Dennis, but were you writing primarily, were you picking these texts and setting them on your own time, or were you mostly writing on commission at this point?
About half my pieces were. Mm. So for
but
a while,
only about half?
Only about half. From 93 to 2000, I would have maybe one commission a year at an orchestra commission somewhere in there, you know, just mm-hmm. for laughs
mm-hmm.
and a chamber piece in there. But I wrote a lot of pieces on spec. I was also writing for my Unitarian Universalist congregation, and
mm-hmm.
that became really powerful too, because that worship is right on that beautiful boundary where the sacred is secular and the secular is sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very inspiring and continues to be inspiring for me.
Another way our experience is different in that way is you were being drawn to write because of the subject, because of the text.
Mm-hmm.
And to a degree also within the community that you were,
yes.
you were part
and
of.
And I also had some Gaelic commissions also. Mm-hmm. It was also
right.
driving me on for that same reason. So yes. but you go ahead.
But similarly, a lot of the music that I was writing was either Gaelic commissions or they were pieces that I wanted to sing with my, mm-hmm. with my a cappella bands. But very little of it was in the marketing mindset.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't, you know, and I sense that might be true with you also, that mm-hmm. I wasn't writing music with the idea of how is this going to be monetized later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
mm-hmm. But because later on, when I had all of this stuff, and this may be true with you too, Elizabeth, people were coming to me to ask, what else mm-hmm. did I have?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, that may be the best reason to have a publishing company
mm-hmm.
is because if I published with someone else, they're not necessarily going to be looking for what do they have of mine?
Mm-hmm.
They are going to look for what do you have that fits my program?
Mm-hmm.
What do you have?
Yes.
For Christmas this year, what do you have on, you know, songs about spring or love
yes.
or social justice or whatever?
Yeah.
I'm doing an entire concert on Emily Dickinson. What have you got?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I figured that if I had a company that was just me, then people would know where to come to find my stuff.
Yeah. And people could look at what you published and know all the sides of you, not just the side that fit in with that publishing company or even smaller that, what's the name for the, within a publishing company, you'll have a series.
Imprint.
An imprint. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Dennis. There's a reason you're here on the phone with us today. I think that being self-published allows me to have all the sides of me out there. I don't have to hide a side of me. I struggled at the beginning. Did I want my church customers to know that I was writing for gala choirs? Did I want people to know I was writing this feminist music? I kind of struggled with this and decided that at some point the public was going to need to know all the sides of me. I was just going to let that be.
Right.
Yeah, not everybody has just one choir that does just one thing. So to have one person who has this choir, like their church choir, and has a high school choir, you want them to know both sides or all the sides so that they can pick the things for their different ensembles.
Right. Well, and in visual art, you know, painters have their portfolios.
Yeah.
And so it's the same kind of idea, you know, one place to say, here it all is.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
You are here to see what I've got.
Exactly.
You are here on this site because you have been drawn here by my name in some other context.
Yeah, yeah.
The one interesting thing is that I'm realizing we're making this sound really fun and wonderful, and it is, but I'm realizing that I started writing my publishing company, Seafarer Press, just turned 20 years old. I know I'm not 25 years old anymore. And I was thinking about what it was like when I started. It was 1996, right at the end of the year for Christmas. I started in December. And I would talk to conductors, and a very small percentage of them got what I was doing. No dealers knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
And for a long time, I'd say from then until for probably the first 10 years, it felt like an uphill battle. I went to an American Choral Directors Association conference in Pittsburgh, and I was the only composer there that I think. There might have been another one that I didn't bump into, but I think I was the only one there.
When did you do that?
That would have been maybe 97.
My goodness.
Wow.
And people would
say, what are you doing here? They would say, what are you doing here? And I would open my satchel and I have this little coral piece of music.
You know, I think the first time that I did this must have been 2007. And Jocelyn and Abby Bettinas. This was in
Jocelyn Hagen.
Yeah, Jocelyn Hagen. Mm-hmm. This was in DC, and we were the only ones
there for a long time.
And we, I felt like we were real curiosities.
Yeah.
I mean, I was lonely,
which was delightful, frankly, because people were at least drawn in to find out what the heck we were doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now it's not nearly as unknown.
It's so different.
But man, in the past 10 years, that sense of the composer's active role in the programming life of choral conductors has really exploded and is quite a marvelous thing. I saw that growing, you know, from the mid-2000s when we started mm-hmm. doing that.
Well, part of it is that it was before the internet. I didn't mm-hmm. have, when I started, I think I might've had, I might've had a email address,
mm-hmm.
but, I was the first artist I knew with a website. There were others I know, but, it was like 1998. I mm-hmm. wrote my own site in mm-hmm. HTML. Nobody had a site.
Yeah.
All my orders came in through the phone.
Me too.
Mm-hmm.
That changed things an awful, awful lot.
Yeah.
And dealers were very wary of dealing with composers.
Oh, I can imagine.
For a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems like,
but
yeah.
That has changed a lot too.
Oh, totally. Totally. So at what point did the two of you and the rest of the
property,
what's that?
What were you going to say?
Oh, I think that there was just like an audio fragment that flew at me. At what point did...
Either that or David was good at talking without moving his lips.
Yeah, yeah. So at what point did the... did you guys start to come together to form the cooperative? How did that come about?
Well, when I think about it, I don't know about you, David, but I think about a conference that Edie Hill and I had been exhibiting together ever since I bumped into her in Toronto at a conference, and we were the only two composers there. and then you and Abby Bettinas also teamed up. I remember we went to National Collegiate Choral Organization.
Mm-hmm.
We were the four of us. And that's when we really started saying, how can we combine what we're doing and do some marketing together?
Yeah.
I don't know. Is that your memory of how that
started? That is my memory. And primarily it was simply to alleviate the expense of exhibiting.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all realized that this was necessary to show up at mm-hmm. ACDA and at Chorus America and NCCO when we were able to, and make those connections with the conductors.
Yeah.
But it was devilishly expensive,
mm-hmm.
for one person, and even just the prosaic stuff like setting the booth up and hauling all of the music and thinking, boy, wouldn't that be nice if there were more than just two people doing this?
Yeah.
I mean, that was my sense. And I know that Abby immediately had much grander ideas about what that could be.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the conversation was about about the website,
mm-hmm.
which could act as, outside of the exhibition world,
mm-hmm.
act as a clearinghouse for all of our catalogs, such
mm-hmm.
that people could come there and search under a topic or a voicing or
mm-hmm.
whatever, and get all of our titles. And then purchase them separately,
mm-hmm.
purchase them from individual composers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, David, just to say that we did these projects together for a few years, four
mm-hmm.
or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden Abby shows up one day with all of us and says, what if we really make this work?
Mm-hmm.
What if we make this happen?
Yeah.
And part of the brainchild that she had at that time was exactly what David was just talking about, this website,
mm-hmm.
and that we would come together more formally. Everything had been so informal. And then at
mm-hmm.
some point, I think Abby just woke up one day and said, let's get married. we're ready to commit. And so I didn't mean to take it away from you, David, but I think what
Ooh,
you're describing
absolutely.
is it, that's our moment where we're going to have a name and we're going to
mm-hmm.
do something together. And it's not just going to be calling somebody else up on the phone and say, what do you think about this one little thing and another little thing?
Mm-hmm.
And that then sparked conversations like, what is it that we have in common when mm-hmm. we describe what this cooperative model thing would be?
Mm-hmm.
Why, who is going to be a part of it, and mm-hmm. why will these people be a part?
Mm-hmm.
And when we look around at who we are, like who's in the room to begin with anyway,
yeah.
What can we say about our work as artists that draws us together? There were some things that we could say, and the most important part of it was that we had an enormous amount of respect and faith in each other's body of work,
mm-hmm.
but also in our track record as successful independent publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the idea of this was that the cooperative would not be in the business of teaching any of its members how to do their jobs,
And that's partly because we wanted to learn from each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we wanted everyone to come in fully engaged. And every single one of us comes in with our own models, our own ideas.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a wallflower. There are eight of us now when we came together as independent music publishers, cooperative. But David's right. The thing that's really important is we're actually crazy about each other's music,
mm-hmm.
which is astonishing, really. I'm still astonished that when we go to a conference and I'm called upon to talk about anybody else's music,
mm-hmm.
I never have to fake it. I never have to say, yeah. well, other people say this is a good piece of music, or I never have to. I feel I don't know.
This has been reviewed well.
And there's so much integrity. I think that's what we're going to talk about now, right? That what you need. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the team players, we agreed from the beginning that there was a sense of abundance.
Mm-hmm.
There was enough success to go around.
Mm-hmm.
We were all going to get where we needed to go better together.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another thing that we,
yeah.
that Abby really pulled us together at the beginning. I think she knew who was going to be part of it, and we put our heads together, but then we had this meeting, and I'm a little embarrassed to say that when we had that first meeting, I didn't think it was going to be any big deal. I said, oh, Abby just wants everybody to get together and have hors d'oeuvres or something. And then suddenly about halfway through the meeting, I thought, well, she's talking about something big.
Yeah.
I didn't get it for a while.
That's great. So go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say our coming out party was in Chicago. And I'm kind of blanking on when that was, Elizabeth. It was 2011.
It was the year that Chorus America's conference. I would say,
yeah.
I would say 2011, but we're both out there.
But you don't know either.
No, I don't know
either. It was either that or 2012. I'm confident of.
Okay. So not too long, too long before I met the group.
Right.
Right. And that was the first time we got together. And instead of having a sign for every individual person, we had this mm-hmm. big old banner and it said Independent Music Publishers Cooperative. And we chose it also because an acronym is IMP,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Which is what we call ourselves.
Which is funny.
I like it.
And because of that, the booth itself, which we lucked out in having a beautifully placed spot.
Mm.
It was kind of at a crossroads in the in the exhibition hall, so people kind of found us from several different directions.
And then it was always really crowded.
Yeah. But we, you know, we interfiled all of our music together also. Mm. That was kind of the point.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When people were looking, because people were browsing music the way that they always browse music like that. They think, well, I've got a women's choir and for the first time, and I've got a concert coming up about Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
So let me find the treble choir stuff and see what they've got for Shakespeare.
Yep.
And there's 8 composers, probably all of which who have pieces on Shakespeare. But from the very beginning, the idea of the cooperative effort, and also the faith that we had in the quality of each other's work was kind of front and center. It was sort of obvious of a lot in that.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked the fact when I was at your booth in Dallas that, everything was interspersed and there was always at least one of you, but usually like at least 2, right there chatting with people saying, oh, you should see this piece. And, Abby, you know, I was like, I want to see what you guys do. And so Abby like went through your whole display and said, you should see this one and you should see that one. And I came away with a piece, I think, by each one of you. So I have them on my shelf in the living room. I liked the fact that you guys treated each other's music with that degree of respect and you knew it so well. You know, it was that was impressive.
It's really important. When I got to show up at a conference and talk about my music and someone else's, it got so much easier.
Yeah.
I suddenly felt like I was even more deeply part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's closer to why I wanted to make music in the first place.
Yeah.
I didn't really decide to be a composer because of the fame, which is good because, or the money. I loved what happened when people made music together and got excited about every person's contribution. And so this was the next logical step.
Yeah. Another thing you guys did that I thought was fantastic. You had a lot of forethought. You all like know the directors that you've worked with a lot. And there were packets ready for specific people, which I thought was awesome that, you know, a director would either stop by or they'd be walking. Well, there was at least some forethought. And it was pretty cool to see, you know, we have this ready for you, or at least you made it seem as though it was like really ready for that person.
Performers are good at this. We really know how
if there wasn't really that forethought, you had me fooled even.
that as a performer, I'll your job is to make it look easy.
Yeah.
We all know how to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that I did like that there were the packets. And I know that these are still like available on your site. Like they're like packets of like samplers of stuff.
Ones for particular years. So when one of them, when a packet from a year sells out, we don't have that year anymore. Mm-hmm. But we usually have the previous years.
Yeah.
Yes, we do. We have copies of all of our previous year's packets. Actually, they're available now if you... is that correct? We were just talking about what to do with those packets.
I like that those were available there on the site. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
So you'd mentioned before we started recording that the cooperative has consistently evolved, and that part of the struggle you guys have gone through is to find the the one model to rule them all.
that's not going to happen. No.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about like what that means and what that struggle has been like and what has come out of that for you?
Well, I think the first place it started was when we realized that all of us had different models for selling music. And I think we referred to that a little bit before, but that somehow has seemed to be the model for, it's the way I think of everything that we do. We're all eight trying to solve a problem for ourselves. And then we're coming together and bringing everything we know about what's working, what's not working, what we need, what we have no clue about what to do. And then there's real, it's very vulnerable actually. I'll get an email quite frequently from one of the other composers saying, you know, I have a problem. Has anybody else encountered this? So at every juncture, this happens. The question comes up, you know, how many conferences are we going to attend? Are we going to attend the conferences? Are we going to bring paper music? Are we going to, as a group, try to sell PDFs? You know, that's like our, we haven't figured that out. We're exploring different possibilities.
I would say then, one of the,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that one thing that is at the heart of the conversation currently is kind of developing our activities beyond exhibiting, because we are exhibiting together somewhat less. There is a, there are different levels of interest in continuing to exhibit the same way. And there's a lot more interest in conversations like producing concerts of based music, or talking about recordings, or talking about you know, our own podcast, or talking about just other ways where collective effort can you know, raise all boats, basically.
The idea of using the internet in the best way we can, which is always, you're always behind the ball when it comes to that question. and then how can we use video? And how can we sometimes do a little bit more from our own locations instead of having to always travel? Everybody's head is in this conversation, which is really exciting. Whether you're on the board or not, we all have a lot of interest in this question. We also have one member who's not in Minneapolis. Joan Shimko is in Portland, and we're doing more and more teleconferencing. That's exciting. We can include people who are more geographically diverse more deeply. and the world just keeps changing. Trying to figure out what, you know, how are we going to pull together in the next years?
Well, I mean, when you think about, when you think that 15 years ago, I mean, you might have been the only independent composer publisher who was exhibiting anywhere at all. You know, and now we're talking about rethinking exhibiting or expanding the idea of just how to market ourselves and our music and develop ourselves and our profiles as artists outside of exhibiting. It's everything is moving so fast, you know. I mean, we have to keep, at no point can you say, well, got this figured out. This is how the world works now. Because we're all kind of professionally creative people, what that means is that we're also likely to become unsatisfied with status quo in a couple of years. So,
We have some really, while all of us, one of the reasons we were able to work together for a long time together, and still are, is because of our passion for choral music. We also have a lot of experimenting and exploring in other areas. Our member Linda Tudis Haugen writes a lot of orchestra music and pieces for voices and orchestra and theatrical works. And so so she's often working with those things and percussion. And meanwhile, Jocelyn Hagen and Tim Takash, who are married to each other, have a whole initiative. And I hope you get a chance to talk to them because it's another really important part of music publishing. Their initiative is growing out of their publishing company, Graphite Publishing, and their new initiative is called Graphite Marketplace. And then that is allowing IMP members and other composers that they've carefully curated to have an automatic way.
Other composer publishers.
Other composer publishers, right? That's true. That's right. Which is a big distinction. Thank you, David.
Yeah.
A composer who's getting we're doing our best to understand the business as well. So Graphite Marketplace is making it possible to have us, to have me have my PDFs sold through Graphite Marketplace without me having to wake up in the morning and figure out what order I have to fill. Which is very exciting for me.
Yeah, it's great.
So they're bringing that idea into us and we're saying, wow, how can we work together with Graphite Marketplace? This is another new paradigm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it has been because Graphite Publishing has been a going concern for for longer than IMP has. There has been a little bit of ongoing confusion, again, is too large a word, but a desire to make sure that IMP and Graphite are separate entities and are not confused by the browsing public.
Well, at the same time, we're holding hands, we're dancing together, we're learning from each other. I just love the whole interdependence before I moved to Minnesota and started working with these other composers and then the independent music publishers cooperative. When I compare my life then to my life now, man, I was so isolated, so lonely. And I love this interdependent flow.
Yeah. That seems like a really just wonderful thing that I think a lot of us really miss, or maybe some don't know they miss it. Like, you know, like feel the need for, I'll feel very cut off from, I just hit my microphone. I feel very cut off from other composers without that sort of thing in place.
Yes. Composing is solitary work.
Yeah.
And many of us are not solitary people.
Oh yeah.
By nature. Yeah. So you have the podcast, Dennis. That's how connect.
Oh yeah, that certainly helps me to get on Zoom like this and chat with people and share ideas, which is fun. But for everybody else on the other end of it, fortunately they get to listen to you guys and listen to everyone. But without that, I think that maybe not day to day, I'm not sure how day to day you guys are with your working together, but without having that that structure in place on a very personal level, it can be difficult.
Ironically, we actually don't see each other as often as you'd think. I mean, like, I can go months without seeing other members of the co-op, but we're emailing, and in some strange way, I have a map in my head of where people are. And I can think to myself, Joan Shimko's out there in Portland and she's writing away and I might know what she's working on. I'll say, she's writing her cantata on Alzheimer's. And then I actually have a map of David in Minneapolis and Edie Hill is north of him, and Linda Tudis Haugen is in Bloomington, and Abby Batinas is a mile away to the east. And have I forgotten somebody? Oh, and Tim and Jocelyn are in Minneapolis. And I actually have a map. Yeah, they're building a house. I have a map in my head. Yeah. And there are days that I actually feel like I'm part of this hive.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all buzzing away.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I think even though we're not like showing up at the office every day,
mm-hmm.
and seeing each other on that kind of regular basis, the fact that we are connected as we are,
mm-hmm.
within this cooperative is significant.
Yeah.
It's not exactly a safety net, I would say, but it is a sense of community that a lot of composers don't get to have.
Yeah. It's not something that taught to necessarily value, I think.
I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah. Yeah. We can sometimes, when we're together, when we're just online,
mm-hmm.
you know, somebody will write and say, I'm completely lost.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what to do next.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm terrified I'm going to miss this deadline.
Mm-hmm.
Or why in the world did I one more time sign a contract for way less money than I should ever accept?
Oh, the eternal question.
There's a sense that, you know, you're not pulling your hair out all by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean you're pulling out my hair. You're pulling out your own hair. And no, in the academic world that I came from, and I say this even having had some terrific teachers,
mm-hmm.
Who were very kind and supportive, but yet there's a kind of invulnerability that you're supposed to cultivate.
Mm, yeah.
And it's such a relief not to have to do that in my daily life now. Mm,
yeah.
I didn't necessarily get the idea that that was the ideal. Rather, that was just the way things were. That mm-hmm. was the way the world went. It wasn't something... When I was in school, I never considered there was another way. If you're going to be a composer, this is what you did.
You had to have kind mm-hmm. of a shell or mm-hmm. a kind of a...
You just became poorly dressed and and antisocial and, you know, and...
Grew your hair out really weird.
Right.
Yeah, I've always had that sense that, you know, we're just expected... We're not taught explicitly to be this way, but it's the model we're given for behavior that we put forward our successes and we hide everything else,
mm-hmm.
and we don't necessarily share anything, whether that's what we're feeling, what we're going through, or what we've just learned, or what we know we need to learn, or a contact, you know, those sorts of things. And it's nice to see a group not doing that, doing the exact opposite. And that's what I'm, you know, hoping to break down a little bit with the podcast, to get us talking about stuff and being a little bit more social with one another and a little less guarded.
Well, did you all feel that other composers within your communities were essentially your rivals, your competitors anyway?
That idea was sort of gently reinforced.
So in one sense, why would you seek them out?
Exactly. Yeah, like you in that model, you wouldn't want to, but then just being a human being and you know, saying we have a shared experience, you're probably going through the same thing I am, like just knowing that I'm another human being going through this, I'm guessing you're probably doing it too, but we don't see that far often.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And in my case, I think one of the things that I was really aware of in school, in college and grad school, was that as a composer, I was supposed to know what I wanted my music to sound like.
Yeah.
I was supposed to know all the pieces. I was supposed to know how long certain sections were going to be and how the balance was going to work. And many composers do actually work that way. Mm-hmm. I think there are, and I actually think of, I think of Stephen Stuckey, who was my mm-hmm. primary professor at Cornell. And actually Jack Gallagher at the College of Worcester, they both Stephen Stuckey worked when he was alive with orchestra quite a lot. And mm-hmm. so did Jack. And so for them, that instrument, they really did imagine this canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have a sense that either of them personally felt a need for the kind of collaboration that I now mm-hmm. thrive on. So maybe it's a kind of a personal way of working
mm-hmm.
where I love going into a rehearsal and finding out that, you know, that I've written something that's going on about a page too long.
Mm-hmm.
And I may not change it then. Mm-hmm. Depends on the choir or the singers,
mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to create suffering in the world. And sometimes that would create suffering.
Oh, yes.
But it's where I'm actively going to my performers and asking. Yeah, I think I'm allowing them to influence what I'm writing mm-hmm. more than I ever thought I would.
Mm-hmm.
I probably vastly oversimplified it. I just have the feeling, or at least, and of course, this was 20 years ago, and I think the academy has changed too. I think
yeah.
universities are a very different place than they were.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard to imagine a professor showing up and saying, "Man, do I have abs when I'm doing this piece? I don't know what." Yeah, that was not. I think that wasn't the way universities were structured then.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to try not to. Now I all I can do now is think of all the exceptions to the generalizations I just made, but I'm going to restrain myself from
stand by them.
All right.
Fight for the validity of your generalizations.
I just really enjoy being an incredibly flawed composer. It's really the most liberating thing. With extremely high standards. That's really amazing. I'm sure you know this, Dennis. You can be really, really flawed and have really super high standards at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I feel very much the same way about my own music. Like, oh, that didn't work, but I have very high standards for it, and the next one will be better. The next one will maybe not make that same mistake. Hopefully not make that same mistake.
That was the best advice I've ever gotten in a composition lesson was whatever went wrong in this, whatever you're not satisfied in this piece, mm-hmm. fix it in the next piece.
Yeah.
The next piece.
Yeah.
Fix it in the next piece. Don't keep rewriting this piece until you get it right.
Yeah. I'm incapable of being that obsessive about the same piece. I'm like, I've finished it. It's not perfect, but it's still good generally. And then the next thing I've learned a lesson from that.
Well, that you are blessed, Dennis. I wish I could say the same.
Well, I also want to get on to the next thing. Oh, so we're at about the 50-ish minute mark. So I wonder, first off, is there anything about the cooperative that we haven't covered yet that we should?
Oh, gosh, there's so many.
I'm sure there's a ton.
Well, I can say when I think about other cooperatives, because there mm-hmm. are a whole variety of other organizations. Some of them call themselves cooperatives or groups.
Or collectives.
Collectives. Yeah. First, I just think it's amazing and wonderful. The more this happens, and I'm sure that they have, each one has its own model and its own priorities.
Mm-hmm.
So the one thing that I think is, if we haven't emphasized it enough, is how it's like any relationship, mm-hmm. and it be, or a family, to allow those to flourish in a whole variety of ways. This is just an exciting time.
Yeah. Now, I don't think we've said this explicitly, but Imp is just choral music? Or does it expand beyond that?
Well, it's a good thing that you said that. It has been.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the reason that we found each other the way that we did.
We found each other. We found each other.
We did. All of us had a particular... have particular reputations as producers of choral music.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, however, as Elizabeth mentioned, we're writing other things, and that's part of the conversation that we need to start having now.
Yeah.
To a degree that we haven't yet, because people are saying, well, this is great, but it's not doing anything for my instrumental chamber music.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things we're doing now, and Jocelyn Hagen is one of the spearheaders of this, is that is exhibiting in at the National Association of Teachers of Singing, NATS. Mm-hmm. So we actually have had, I think, at the last NATS conference, which was a little over a year ago, Abby Bettinas and Jocelyn Hagen went, and my music was there. I don't know who else's music was there. And I know we're planning on having some kind of presence in Las Vegas. And that may be all of a project that Imp does, or maybe one that Jocelyn spearheads more. That's always something we negotiate when but that's definitely
right. And the question,
a lot of us have art songs.
That's true. The question of how visible, if at all, the Imp name is at circumstances like that is becoming that's sort of flexible. That's in flux, because it kind of doesn't matter in a sense, because we're already networked, the eight of us. You know, we kind of have the opportunity to send our music with Jocelyn. If she goes, maybe Imp doesn't have a booth as such, but those of us who have art songs have just know about an opportunity that we wouldn't have known about otherwise.
Yeah.
So we are moving into that direction. There's been some talk about having a presence at Chamber Music America. We don't know. We may do that. We may not. Meanwhile, you know, we're all moving in these amazing directions. Jocelyn just wrote a piece with Keytar, which apparently is a guitar with a keyboard on it.
Yeah.
Oh, come on, that. Elizabeth. You grew up in the 70s.
I didn't know
what
a
keytar is.
I didn't know what a keytar was. I thought it was, you know, a guitar with like an accordion guitar. You know, I don't know what I thought it was. But I certainly never had a piece like that. And, I'm writing a country music musical right now. We're going
nice.
In all these amazing
nice.
Directions. E.D. Hill is writing gorgeous chamber music. We're trying to figure out, how do we keep helping each other? How do we collaborate and yet stay in connection with each other?
Yeah.
I think we don't really know, but I feel like what we have, these connections, are going to be nourishing us as we go forward. And I know I've never experienced anything like this, where everyone is in, we all see ourselves as having a common, you know, successes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when my friends used to get grants that I applied for and I didn't get it, I used to just... You know, my mother taught me well. I would say, oh, that's wonderful. Really, really. But you know, what has happened is it's actually, maybe it's where I am in my life, or maybe it's this I no longer feel that way. When mm-hmm. someone, I truly feel like I'm celebrating everyone's successes in mm-hmm. a way that I never felt like I could.
Yeah.
And it's because we all have each other's, you know, I just heard from Tim Takash. He says, I have a choir. What do you have? And he's just this composer guy.
Yeah.
And we're all, you know, we're all helping each other figure out who we are.
Yeah. Just, that's fantastic. And hop back to something that David said earlier about the, wondering about the visibility of the Imp name. One thing that I like just compulsively come back to is the world of books. You know, nobody pays attention to, like, think of your favorite book. Who published it? You know, right. And so I think, like, the publisher itself at a certain degree no longer matters on the consumer side. I think what you guys have done, Imp, I think, has allowed all of you to create, like, you have your shared vision, and you have, like, actually made a name for the cooperative. But in doing so, I think each of you ends up ideally eclipsing, like, your names end up eclipsing Imp. Because people are like they may say, okay, these people are all high quality and they're all working together and they're working together. But you know what? It's more about David, it's more and Elizabeth and Abby. It's not mm-hmm. Imp. It's the human beings behind it, the creators that
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
I mean, eventually, you know,
yeah, I think that's true.
My parents are not on my bio, mm-hmm. although actually sometimes I slip them in.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that my parents weren't this incredibly integral part to where I am.
Yeah. And it's not that it's not that, you know, Hachette doesn't do, like, great work on behalf of its writers when they're not using them as human shields. But that was a couple of years ago. You know, like, I'm just thinking of the book that I just finished, which is, you know, like, it's published by Hachette under the imprint Orbit. Who cares? It's by N.K. Mm-hmm. Jemisin. Mm-hmm. Like, I care about her work. And the company that puts it out does great work on her behalf. And so I think, like, right. Imp does, you know, like, it is you guys. But ultimately, I think individually you will, if not have already to a degree, like, eclipsed the company because of, like, your work individually and together. Does that make...
It's true. It does. I think that, like a good publisher, and especially like a sort of boutique publisher
mm-hmm.
that has a clear stylistic
mm-hmm.
vision.
Mm-hmm.
If someone becomes aware of Imp because they're devotees of Elizabeth's music,
mm-hmm.
Once they're walking around the Imp promenade,
mm-hmm.
They are more likely to have faith in the other composers
yes.
that they would find
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Elizabeth there is therefore the kind of the gateway drug,
mm-hmm.
you know, to all of the rest of us. But because there are only eight of us,
mm-hmm.
it's more likely that people would spend some time
yes.
to listen to Linda's music
mm-hmm.
because, you know, she has shared some of the gloss of
mm-hmm.
of Elizabeth on, you know, on the director who's browsing.
Oh yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
That wouldn't work so well if we were Hal Leonard.
Yeah.
Where we have 50,000 different composers.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't make any assumptions about another composer that you might find in Hal Leonard because someone you like is published by them.
Yeah,
I think this is going to be more and more important in the future. This is interesting because David and I talked today before this interview, and I came away thinking, wow, I don't know anything about the future. And I suddenly realized I know something about the future. That as the internet becomes this marketplace where you can go and you can, in 1 hour, you could find yourself 20,000 pieces for your ensemble, just like that. The need for curated or a boutique kind of area, those are going to get to be more and more important. It's why an organization like IMP, where we all have very high compositional standards and also engraving standards and proofreading standards, is important. And graphite,
all the thumbs up.
I believe that's true. And then Jocelyn and Hagen and Tim Takash's graphite publishing and graphite marketplace is also heavily curated. This is not a place where every composer can just come and say, I've taken 4 composition lessons and here's my piece.
Yeah.
They've really tried to make that a place where you know that there's a minimum standard of craft and vision. We're going to see that in the next decade. That's going to be the big challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, the curatorial element of what you do is super important. Yeah.
That's my fear that somebody's going to go look for my music and it's going to be lost as one molecule in a vast ocean of other music. And we'll never find each other.
Yeah.
Me and the perfect performance.
I know.
Right.
I know. So, I guess it's about time to left over the hour. So, I wonder if there's any lessons you've learned through IMP that you think would benefit composers who are listening.
One thing I think about that I learned working with the other composers is actually about tabling my own agenda of where I think the organization should go. And I've learned this both by tabling it and seeing how well that sometimes went. And I've also learned that by thinking I knew the one true way for the organization to go and finding that this was not working. So I think that is... in some ways, the personalities are really important. I know I've learned, in fact, even, I was president last year and David is president this year. And as I had my own way of doing the meetings, I knew what I wanted to do. And it was really important for me to sit down with myself and say, it's David's turn, and where David leads, not that we're not all part of it, that's going to be the direction. And I'm more interested in being with them than getting my way. I think that's, so that's maybe my, I would say that to anybody who's a member of a cooperative or a coalition.
Nice.
Well, I guess the two that I can think of are, in the creative, in any professionally creative realm, your colleagues are not necessarily your rivals. And just like in any art, in this particular kind of cooperative, death to the status quo. I mean, it's true. I mean, and the status quo that is most that is most binding and the most the biggest stumbling block to progress and innovation are the assumptions that we all carry within us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the important thing. This is the way that the business is done. And so this is the way we're going to keep
doing
bloody-mindedly fighting to do it this way.
Well said, David.
Yeah.
It's, it's hard to let go of that old model of success that has worked
for so long.
Well, and the thing is that the old model of success might be a year old.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Just nothing can be taken for granted, and that's terrifying and exhilarating all the time.
I know. It's great. Like, when you mentioned that the first time that, David, that you'd gone to a conference was, like, around 2007, that's the year the first iPhone came out. Like, that...
Think of it!
How much has changed, you know, in that time, and there's so much to keep up with. There's so much to like, not only to keep up with, but like also to help us along the way.
Right.
Yes.
And yeah.
Right.
So.
And I think that that goes back to the question that you were asking about what is the model of IMP. We kind of, in one sense, have to. We have to strongly avoid having a model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, except to continually be the change
mm-hmm.
that we want to see happen in the industry.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's a balance though, because
mm-hmm.
we actually are a cooperative. We're a legal cooperative. We
mm-hmm.
have bylaws.
Yep.
We have a mission statement.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are always balancing that, which is the beautiful tension,
mm-hmm.
just like in music,
yeah.
dissonance consonant.
Nice, cool. So where can we find you, all of you online?
Ah, well, collectively we are www.imp.coop. It's www.imp.coop, and from there you can find any of us.
Nice.
One for all and all for one.
That's great. Are you guys active at all on the Facebooks and the Twitters and stuff like that, where people can connect?
We are, and that's just. Yeah, we each have our own web pages,
mm-hmm.
and we have the collective IMP site. This year, we just put into effect a monthly rotation where we're kind of minding the Facebook store.
Oh, cool.
Not a store. It's
yeah.
not a store there.
Yeah.
But,
right.
So that...
But there is an IMP Facebook page.
An
cool.
IMP Facebook page.
Cool.
And it's really fun. My month was September, and my little job was to snoop around and find all the exciting things that the other members were doing. And I got to listen to their music at the same time.
Nice.
And whatever I was interested in,
mm-hmm.
that's what went up on the page in September.
Nice.
So that was a really fun job.
Cool. Well, thank you guys so much for being here on this, Tuesday evening. Yeah,
this has been great.
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun. I'm like slightly out of practice. It's been actually a few months since my last episode because things have been crazy. I don't know if you heard.
We talked your ear off, actually.
Oh, but I love it. That's the point. I don't know if you could hear like throughout the whole hour and change, our cat has been on the other side of the door yowling. I'm sure that will come through in the actual, he is such a sad, lonely cat right now.
Meow.
Oh, roar. It's like, oh, pistachio. But thank you so much for being here and doing this. Elizabeth, I'm glad you reached out and that we could make this happen. So yeah, stick around for a minute while I end things.
Yes.
Everybody, thank you guys so much for listening and putting up with my little hiatus there. I guess, yeah, again, so out of practice, don't even think about how to end the show. So thanks, everybody, and I will talk to you next time.